Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There is a resource in Washington, D.C., whose intelligence on many aspects of that war for the free world is, well, unsurpassed, and it is called the Investigative Project on Terrorism, founded by the great Steve Emerson. One of its principal go-to resources is its senior counterterrorism analyst, John Rossomondo. He's an investigative reporter of some quite extraordinary accomplishment and acclaim. And these days, he is doing really indispensable writing and analysis at IPT on, among other things, Iran. And I wanted to catch up with him in the aftermath of the demise of Qasem Soleimani and sort of take stock as to what seems to be happening, both with respect to Iran and its behavior, and perhaps some of its future options. John Rossomondo, it's good to have you back. Happy New Year to you, sir. Welcome once again to Secure Freedom Radio. So, John, Iran has, it seems, decided not to engage in further retaliation against the United States for the elimination of Soleimani. It has, of course, the option of doing so, and we'll talk about that in a moment, perhaps even here. But what is your current reading on whether, as Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, has claimed earlier in the week, we have successfully restored deterrence against this regime, and what that might portend for its future prospects, among other things, at the hands of its own people?
Frank, I would definitely agree with him. Because if Iran had wanted to carry out more of attacks, we might have seen a lot more of action than firing some horribly inaccurate missiles at U.S. forces after Soleimani's demise. And, the thing I thought was kind of amusing, and a lot of people have, is the propaganda. Iran is united because the IRGC and the besieged militia, went and forced shopkeepers into the streets to attend Soleimani's funeral and said, this is one big demonstration of national unity and that the United States is hated by Iran. But we've seen the exact opposite since the shootdown of the Ukrainian airliner by the Revolutionary Guard. It's galvanized people who are just totally fed up with the regime. We've seen banners of Soleimani torn down, calls for the Ayatollah's ouster, people ripping down the Islamic Republic's flags all over the country. But the one thing that's keeping them in power is the repression of the IRGC. So we need to keep ramping up our pressure on Iran, like we ramped up economic and political pressure against the Soviet Union.
Indeed, I remember well the effort Ronald Reagan made to that end, and ultimately how what we were assured was a permanent fixture on the world stage, namely the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, went from being a fact to the ash heap of history in a twinkling of an eye, really, but not by accident, and certainly not because Gorbachev wanted it to go there, but because of that pressure campaign. And are you saying, John Rossomondo, that you see some possibilities that the present environment in Iran, where these people are courageously putting themselves in mortal peril by taking the sorts of steps you've described, may conduce to a similar kind of removal from power of the mullahs?
Well, I think that we see pressure building. It took years for the Soviet Union to collapse between, like, 1985 and 1991. I mean, I think that the big thing will happen when the Ayatollah Khamenei passes away. He's an old man in his 80s. And I think that we're seeing the real Iran. I mean, the real Iran is pro-American. The real Iran is the people who have maintained the culture that was existing under the Shah. I have talked with people who come to this country from Iran in the past 5 years, and that's what they say. I mean, they're as liberal as we are, but they're held hostage by this regime. So I don't think that time is on these old men's side.
Well, let us hope so, and everything that we can do, it seems to me, should be designed to shorten that. Let me ask you in particular about a concern that I have, John. You've spent a lot of your time and work at the Investigative Project on Terrorism focused on what I call the enemy within problem, the presence in our country of Sharia supremacists of various colorations, the Muslim Brotherhood, for example. But I'm particularly interested in your thoughts about Hezbollah, the sort of IRGC foreign legion, if you will, that has been operating worldwide, much of it in the Middle East, but also in Latin America. And we're told that has cells in this country as well. I wonder what your sources are telling you about the danger that those such entities here might pose to us in the event that the Iranian regime decides to return to a more active, shall we say, and violent form of response to the United States pressure?
Well, I mean, I don't want to be overly alarmist, but we saw in 2011 that the IRGC conspired to work with the drug cartels to assassinate the Saudi ambassador here in the U.S. They have presences across the country, and if the Iranians want to, I mean, there's no shortage of people who would possibly be willing to act on their behalf. In Michigan, you have a big population of Hezbollah supporters. I don't know, whether we would end up having the attacks, because I don't want to, jump the gun. But it's not without the realm of possibility that Iran could do some damage.
And the damage could be quite considerable, given that we're told these groups have been doing reconnaissance for years on various targets, our electric grid, perhaps other critical infrastructure and military targets among them. John Rossomondo, we have to leave it at that for the moment. We look forward to talking with you often, though, in 2020. I hope you will give our regards to Steve Emerson and the rest of your team at the Indispensable Investigative Project on Terrorism and come back to us early and often in this new year. Next up, we will speak with Diana West about the latest on the impeachment of President Trump and the larger anti-Trump conspiracy, of which this is just the latest manifestation. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined by Diana West, one of our rock stars on program. Each week we feature her, bringing her insights into, among other things, the enemy within problem, the anti-Trump conspiracy, as she calls it, in the subtitle to her newest book, The Red Thread, a search for ideological drivers in the anti-Trump conspiracy. Diana is also the author of two other superb books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal. She blogs at dianawest.net and is, well, a national treasure by my lights. It's always good to have her with us. Welcome back, Diana. Good to have you. Let's talk a little bit about the news of the day as we speak. It is in prospect. By the time this program airs, it will have happened. The House of Representatives will vote to transfer at long last the articles of impeachment that were so urgently adopted a few weeks back, 28 days, I think, to be precise. But they just couldn't quite get around to getting them over to the Senate until now. What are we to make of the state of play at the moment, the prospects for this trial in the Senate on these dubious articles of impeachment?
Well, we're going to see continued dripping out of information, supposed bombshells, the media playing along, and we don't exactly know what the impeachment trial will look like, but the tragedy of our time is we will be seeing an impeachment trial based on these just utterly fraudulent, concocted articles of impeachment.
And I think there's reason to believe that there will be at least some number of Republican senators who will be voting to provide a platform in the Senate for witnesses who will help with exactly that kind of dripping out, if you will, Chinese water torture that is the object of the left, the Democratic opposition to Trump. To the extent that that will happen, Diana, I gather that there are essentially limited options for the majority leader or for the other Republicans to try to minimize the likelihood that this thing becomes simply a new version of the House witch hunt. Are you concerned about that?
I am terribly concerned about that. I mean, the whole thing essentially becomes the headquarters of Trump disinformation aimed at the 2020 election. I mean, this is not about protecting the Constitution or hearing a case. This is all agitprop designed to foment animus and distrust of the president as he is campaigning for office. By taking that incredibly important role of actually letting the people decide away from us, I mean, this is such an anti-democratic small d measure that it's almost hard to fathom at this point, but we have to watch how it takes shape. But all the signs are bad at this point in terms of getting any kind of swift outcome for sure, or even any kind of clean outcome. I'm very worried about the Senate Republicans, who are so terribly weak in their support of President Trump. And as this moves into a political play, a political show trial, I believe you will see them increasingly work with the Democrats against him.
Not all of them, obviously, but some, enough. It doesn't have to be more than four or five. And the trouble, of course, is that there are an awful lot of, let's be honest, establishment Republicans who've never been keen on Donald Trump. I think it would be the death knell for the Republicans in the Senate more generally if they were to find in support of the left and the Democratic agenda on this, needless to say. Diana, let me just hit a couple of other topics that are part and parcel, really, of this coup against the president, the anti-Trump conspiracy, as you've called it. We had a prime example of the miscarriage of justice that has been entailed in previous iterations of this coup in the FISA process. Following the Inspector General of the Department of Justice report, which found 17 different very serious flaws in how the FBI conducted itself. The current FBI Director Christopher Wray advised the FISA court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court, that he, quote, deeply regrets, unquote, the many errors that the Bureau perpetrated here. Does that constitute, as you see it, an admission that there was some purposeful wrongdoing here, or is this simply a means of trying to deflect attention and just move on? Nothing to see here, folks.
Well, it's an outrage. It's an utter outrage. I mean, this really is the end in terms of brazenness, in my view. I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, but it's as if John Dillinger were to say he committed a series of serious errors in going into the bank and holding it up. I mean, we had this discussion, this report, these series of, you can call them errors if you're trying to be nice, but breaches of protocol and the law in terms of setting up a domestic spying operation on the political opposition. And the FBI, as the state security agency, the police, the federal police, is now telling us that it really was nothing more than a series of errors. And in other words, no one will be charged, no one will be fired. This will just be done in a more official manner in the next time. And this is essentially Barr's message, the Attorney General's message, when he said that the fixes will include a sign-off by the Attorney General and the FBI Director. Well, last time around, that would have been James Comey and Loretta Lynch. And they were deeply involved in this entire orchestrated effort to thwart Donald Trump's candidacy and then moving into the coup, as we call it, and rightly so, I believe, that we've watched ever since. So this becomes the foxes essentially deciding that the foxes will be better at what they do next time. And, you know, forget about the sheep.
The sheep will be eaten is the bottom line, of course. Diana, speaking of the sheep being eaten, there was an Obama-nominated U.S. attorney by the name of John Huber, charged by the former Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, to investigate whether there had been some kind of wrongdoing by Hillary Clinton and the Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton, Chelsea Clinton Foundation. And this fellow, John Huber, found that there wasn't any wrongdoing. How could that possibly be?
Well, looking back at our previous subject, it is what it is. It is a situation where you look at the Department of Justice and you have to start seeing the words criminal gang in a thought bubble over the building. I mean, this is a sorry, sorry day for America. But on the other hand, I'm less keenly stabbed in the back by the Huber report because I never believed it was anything. And I frankly found the notion of its arrival as the return of virtue and good as a ridiculous notion from the start. It just never smelled correctly to me. And essentially it became sort of a holding action for conservatives to be waiting and remaining complacent in a sense in terms of expecting that the adults would return, the authorities would reimpose law and order, and that's just not happening. And frankly, I feel the same way, I'm afraid to say, about the onset of the Durham report, whenever or wherever or however that will be. This seems to be a pattern that we need to recognize, that we are being slow-walked into oblivion, slow-walked into Nowheresville as far as getting any kind of reckoning, any kind of law and order, any kind of prosecution of hugely powerful leaders doing corrupt things at the top of our government. And certainly the Clinton Foundation, the pay-to-play slush fund of the ages, being cleared is just a terrible sign of that. And what is the fallout from that? Are we hearing about investigations on the Hill about that? No. We're going to be looking into the president's phone call or what have you. I mean, this is where we are, and it's all deflection. It's all this terrible kind of play. Again, so much of this is just artificial creation, sort of an ersatz play for people to watch and assume something's being done, and it's really we're being done. I mean, this is we're being done too. This is all to the bad.
It comes back to the sheep being eaten again. But I have to say, I put more stock in John Durham. I hope I'm right and you're wrong, Diana. We'll be watching this closely. But it will be the end, as far as I'm concerned, if the rule of law is once again completely and summarily dispensed with by a U.S. attorney who is renowned for having, you know, taken it to the FBI and other agencies when they've engaged in wrongdoing. So we'll be watching this space very closely with you and others. Quickly, Diana West, just a comment. Mike Flynn, who is a personal friend and a man I've admired for a long time, has just revoked or retracted the guilty plea that he filed. And I think this is a pretty important development. What do you make of it and the timing in particular?
Well, you know, this was a I guess long hoped for development, and it is a big moment in that case. Again, this is another one of these terrible exercises in injustice that we've been watching drag out, and we're finding even more about this case in the sense that this is a case about lying to the FBI. The FBI agents have claimed in their own official communications he did not lie. We also now find from Devin Nunes, former chairman of the Intelligence Committee, that they knew this back in early 2017 from the FBI agents, and Devin Nunes said his committee told the Justice Department about this back then. So again, we're looking at another one of these show trials that we're watching in real time. He speaks out about the need for people to support General Flynn, to speak out for him, but I'm saying, where's the police? Where's the law and order? Where are the where do we see the Justice Department now under William Barr continuing now to press for jail time for General Flynn? I mean, this has to be on Attorney General Barr at this point. His prosecutors have decided to seek jail time only recently for General Flynn. What is this all about? How does this work? I am not a legal expert. I can't explain the excellent Sidney Powell's determination on this change in the case for her client at this point. It just seems like, yes, the more truth that is told, the more that General Flynn makes it clear that he was telling the truth and was under duress, which I believe is the explanation for this change, that the government did not operate in good faith, etc., and this has caused him to change his plea, the better. We will have to watch the space and see how it develops, but I certainly hope it develops in his favor. Gone through so much. Too much.
There needs to be accountability on this case, as in all the others that we've discussed. Diana West, we have to leave it at that. Thank you for your time today, as well as the great work you would do at dianawest.net. Check it out, folks. Next up, we will speak with Suzanne Schulte, a hero in the effort to provide freedom for the people of North Korea, about negotiations with the North and more. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. It's a pleasure to say, joined by a woman that I have come to admire enormously over many, many years, as I've watched her working tirelessly on behalf of freedom in general and in particular for freedom in North Korea, the hermit kingdom that has not known much of it since it was taken over by Stalin's proxy, Kim Il-sung. Her name is Suzanne Schulte. She is the president of a wonderful organization, the Defense Forum Foundation, as well as a leader in two other organizations directly relevant to the problem confronting us and the rest of the world, for that matter, from North Korea. She is the chairman of the North Korean Freedom Coalition and the honorary chairman of something called Free North Korea Radio, which is run and staffed by defectors from the North broadcasting news and information back into their home country. A remarkable woman of great accomplishment. It is a delight to have her back with us. Suzanne, thank you for taking a few minutes to catch up with us on what's going on with North Korea and what it means for all of us. So we are hearing from President Trump's national security advisor, his current one, that is, Robert O'Brien, that he's quite keen to get going once again with the talks with North Korea on denuclearization of the peninsula, and that this exchange of letters, birthday congratulations, and so on is all a good sign. His previous national security advisor, John Bolton, however, has poured a bit of cold water on all of this with Axios recently, essentially saying this is a complete mug's game. It's not going to amount to anything at all. Give us your reading, Suzanne, as a close student and observer of what's happening in North Korea. Who's right and what the prospects are, were we to get back into negotiations with the North of anything other than more life support for the regime there?
Well, first of all, let me begin by saying that watching Trump and Kim exchange love letters and meeting makes me physically ill. But I absolutely believe that there is a strategy that Trump is following. And I say that because, you know, he is the first president that spoke out the most passionately and the most detailed about the violations of human rights in North Korea. That was one of the things that we complained bitterly about with Clinton, with Bush. And to a certain extent with Obama, is that there wasn't a big push on the human rights issue, which is the Achilles heel of the Kim regime, according to Hwang Jong-yap, highest-ranking defector. So remember that the first year, Trump was passionate about North Korea human rights issues, speaking out that wonderful speech he gave at the South Korean Assembly, focusing on them at the State of the Union, what was happening with hosting Ji Sung-ho and the man that escaped. So I think Trump cares very deeply for the people of North Korea. But he inherited a horrible situation. There had already been 5 nuke tests, one during his first year. He has a president in South Korea, which is problematic, which we can talk about later. But I believe Trump is using his best skills to try to get a breakthrough here. And I absolutely believe that, even though it looks pretty awful. And here's why. First of all, Singapore summit, that video he showed at the Singapore summit showed You can have Kim Jong-un, you can have Singapore, you can have prosperity, you can bring great wealth to your country, or what was in the next frame, a mushroom cloud, or your regime's over. And I think he's trying to show him a way forward, because remember, even in Singapore, Kim Jong-un did agree to denuclearize. That was part of the agreement. Now, is this strategy working? Looking at it, you would think it doesn't look like it's working at all, because Kim Jong-un is still making threats. But you know what? We didn't get a Christmas surprise. But Kim is never going to give up his nuclear weapons. So I think John Bolton is absolutely right about that. He's just waiting this out. And I think the impeachment very likely slowed progress both with China and with North Korea, because these dictators, when they don't like a president, they just want to wait them out. But I think Trump's strategy is internal pressure, which he has definitely done. People are still trying to escape. What is Kim doing right now? He's sent more patrols to the border. He's trying to get a stop, aggressively stop outside information from coming in. So he is feeling the internal pressure because of these sanctions. So, and I think also what happened with Vietnam, remember that Biden went to the envoy for North Korea, went to Stanford and gave that speech about, oh, we want economic prosperity for North Korea. We want economic prosperity. And when Kim Jong-un showed up in the Vietnam summit, he thought he was going to get a deal. But Trump said, no, denuke first, then money. And so what happened is he walked away. So it's almost like Trump set him up. But Trump's been very strong about this. So I think it's a maximum pressure. Now, I, of course, would like to see more discussion about the human rights issues. I also think we need to do what we can to interdict this coal and the oil shipments, because that's where the money's coming in, and stop the slave labor. The UN needs to stop the slave labor of North Korean workers.
That slave labor is they're sending North Korean citizens overseas to earn hard currency and send them back basically to the regime, but they're working under essentially slave labor conditions.
Exactly, and it's happening in so many countries. It brings in they're saying as much as $500 billion to the regime. I think that's dropped significantly, but because of the UN calling for that practice to end. But we still see that happening in China and Russia, and there's some confusion about whether the African nations have returned the slave laborers that were in Africa. But Vietnam, especially Russia, especially China, it's still many workers there, cold cash to Kim Jong-un.
And that's a lot of life support for an odious regime like this. So it's really important to cut that off. You're absolutely right, Suzanne Schulte. You mentioned a couple of things that I just want to touch on quickly, a lightning round, basically. You mentioned China. One of my concerns has been that Kim may have been somewhat more tractable. I don't know that he would give up his nuclear weapons, but that he may have been more willing to participate in this, were it not for China pulling his leash and saying, no, you're not going to do that. This fits the pattern of China, of course, being unhelpful, of professing to be an intermediary and so on. But how do you see China's role in all of this at the moment, Suzanne? And is this part of Trump's larger strategy to essentially try to separate the North from China?
I absolutely think that is part of his largest strategy to separate them, because China wants to make sure that Kim Jong-un stays in power. And, you know, they'll do everything they can to undermine any progress that we're making. So I'm so grateful that the president is really pressing China, because they would rather see a nuclear state in North Korea with a dictator on their border than a unified Korea that would be an incredible economic powerhouse and a glowing example of why free markets and freedom is the way your people can prosper. Because Korea gives us our best stark example of two people, the same people, and China doesn't want that. So they absolutely will do everything they can to make sure Kim stays in power. So Trump's strategy to separate them is critical.
Let's talk about this fellow Moon Jae-in, the president of South Korea, and the role that he's playing. As I mentioned, you are the honorary chairman of the Free North Korea Radio operation, which is incredibly important. You mentioned sort of information operations are seen as a real threat to the regime in the North, that they're trying desperately to keep their own people from understanding what's possible for them, particularly what life is like across the border in the South. Yet the president of South Korea, Moon Jae-in, is seemingly increasingly at odds with those who are refugees from the regime, defectors and otherwise, and to the point where he's even sent some some back to certain death. What's going on with Moon Jae-in, and put it into this larger context of the relationship between his country and the North, and what it means for, you know, not only our own diplomacy, but our security interests on the peninsula?
It's absolutely frightening what's happening in South Korea. Moon Jae-in is acting on behalf of Kim Jong-un, not on behalf of the people of South Korea. And I know that seems crazy because we think of South Korea as this vibrant democracy. But even Gordon Chang has warned that if the opposition party to Moon doesn't win the elections in April, South Korea's republic is over. That's how desperate it is. Now, let me give you some examples from my perspective of what's happened with North Korea. For the first time ever, North Korean defectors seeking asylum were forced back to North Korea by the Moon regime. They claimed these defectors had killed other people on the fishing boat that they were on. Even if they had done that, they still were seeking asylum and should have gone through the judicial process in South Korea. That was a violation of the Republic of Korea's constitution to force them back. But also, Moon has cut off all the support that the North Korean defector NGOs once had. Even the Committee for the Democratization of North Korea, which is the longest existing North Korean defector NGO that even was supported during the leftist governments, even that particular NGO has lost all their support. They're intimidating the defectors into silence. And you mentioned Free North Korea Radio. We are so blessed. Free North Korea Radio is a partnership between freedom-loving Americans and North Korean defectors. It's a beacon of hope for the people of North Korea, but now it's become a beacon of hope for the people in South Korea because they can't stop us, because we don't get any funding from the government. We're totally supported by private citizens, churches, and so we're able to continue doing what we're doing, even though Moon is silencing the voices of the defectors, undermining them, cutting them off, sending them back against their will. It's awful what's happening.
And it suggests to me, at least, that there is a determination on his part, as you say, not in the interest of the South Korean people, but his own pursuit of long-standing hard left agenda, that he's seeking a separate peace with the North Koreans, a unification, even if it's on North Korea's terms. And this is very ominous indeed for freedom in general, of course, but as well for the vital interests of the United States in that part of the world. And Suzanne, I appreciate so much what you're doing. It's obvious that the government of North Korea does not. It has been threatening you. It has been using your Defense Freedom Foundation as a vehicle for some of its own information operations and cyber warfare, a testament to your effectiveness and great work. I know you'll keep it up and that you'll return, hopefully, often to us in 2020 to update us about what's going on there. It's the front lines of freedom, for sure. God bless you, my dear. Stay well. Next up, we will be speaking with Gary Schiff about a remarkable new idea to turn the boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign on its head. That and more, straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to welcome for the first time to our microphones Gary Schiff. I want to make clear he is no relation to the odious Adam Schiff, of notoriety at the moment. He is a man with a long background in forestry in the United States, having served in the U.S. Forest Service, having also been a staff member on the House Natural Resource Committee, and the former policy director for the nation's 50 state foresters. But he made Aliyah to Israel, a nation which has had an extraordinary story about forestry as well. But we're going to talk with him about another topic, something he wrote about for the Jewish News Syndicate recently that caught my eye, about the BDS movement. It stands for Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Against the State of Israel. But he and friends of his in Israel are giving a whole new meaning to that acronym. And we're going to talk a bit about that. But first, let me welcome Gary and ask him to just tell us a little bit about the BDS movement here in the United States and elsewhere around the world.
Thanks, Frank, very much. First, I want to thank you, Frank, for all that you do in highlighting the threats that face us. I mean, you provide the ammunition for all of us, so I just need to start with that. But The BDS movement is you know, today's modern form of anti-Semitism. I think all of us thought, you know, without the state, if we have the state of Israel, we won't have anti-Semitism. So instead of anti-Semitism, now we have, you know, anti-Zionism, and it's becoming mainstreamed and okay, and it's a horrendous problem on college campuses. And so, you know, it needs to be fought with everything we can. It is all you can say about it. It's just pure anti-Semitism.
It's being brought to college campuses, as you say, in this country and to audiences elsewhere around the world through, I think, primarily this group, Students for Justice in Palestine, which is a rabidly anti, as you say, Zionist, anti-Israel, then also anti-Semitic operation, I believe, funded by George Soros and the like. And it has been operating for some time, indoctrinating American youth, among others, into believing that it's really okay to be anti-Semitic as long as you sort of obscure it with this anti-Israel coloration. And you were telling me off air, Gary, a couple of stories about the utter lie that is at the heart of all of this, that Israel is somehow an apartheid state because it discriminates against Arabs and other foreign nations. Tell us some of your own personal, your children's personal experiences in Israel that belie that.
I'd love to, Frank. You know, my son was in the IDF, and I'm looking at a picture in my office here of his basic training unit. And in that unit, I'm looking at two Ethiopians, two folks from Belarus, two Moroccan, French Moroccans, a Christian kid, and of course the Jewish American kid from Taos, who was born in Taos, New Mexico. This is not the picture of a racist nation, you know. I'd also share with you a couple of stories from my daughters. One daughter works for or was working for a urgent care center. In the urgent care center, half the doctors and half the nurses were Arabs from places like Ramallah and Hebron, et cetera. And, you know, they were trained in Israel. And even my other daughter was working for a group called Save a Child's Heart. This is an organization that flies in children from all over the world, and a lot of them from African countries, and a lot of them from countries that aren't so friendly to Israel, and fixes their hearts here in Israel. This is not the picture. To me, Israel's a role model. It is the exact opposite of what BDS is talking about.
And this is why it's so defamatory and so harmful that Israel is being maligned in this fashion without foundation. So tell us a little bit, Gary Schiff, about what you and others are doing now to transform this hateful weapon against Israel into something that people who support it can do to demonstrate that support and counter this so-called BDS affair.
Thanks, Frank. We just came up with this little acronym, Buy Directly from Samaria, but it's also Buy Directly from Judea and Buy Directly from the Golan and actually Buy Directly from all of Israel. But, you know, there are a few things I would just share. I want to just mention Ron Dermer, Ambassador Dermer. What he did is in 2015, what he did is he sent out gift boxes to all of the places where the ambassador sends gift boxes, including the Obama administration, and the products were from Judea and Samaria. There is an opportunity to buy products from Judea and Samaria that are, wine. There's property. There's skincare products. There's olive oils. There's a whole host of things if you go online of all the things that come from Judea, Samaria, and the Golan. And I would just encourage people to support with your wallet. There's 600 million evangelical Christians in the world, and how many others, Catholics, Mormons, Hindus, etc., that support Israel. I think that the support is broad. And the first thing is exactly that, is the support. The second thing would be to come visit. And when you come visit where? Judea and Samaria and the Golan. You know, make sure to see, the biblical, much of what happened in our Bible, our common Bible, happened in Judea and Samaria. You have to see those places, and you have to see the life that's happening over there. And then you know, the other thing is just to talk up Israel and all the amazing things that are going on. In the high-tech world, you cannot believe what's happening. And, in some sense, I've talked to one of the venture capital folks there, and he has said that in some ways, BDS has called attention to all of the things that Israel is doing well in a backhanded way. It's turned a curse into a bit of a blessing in certain ways. I mean, you have 250 multinational companies that now have their R&D facilities here in Israel. So there's a few things I think people could do.
If you were to Google under buy directly from Samaria, would people be able to find vehicles for doing that?
I think so. I think absolutely. And Judea.
It's a clever way, of course, of turning the acronym on its head. And just a quick take from, you've made Aliyah to Israel, you are now residing there, Gary Schiff. How important to a nation like Israel at a moment like this, when Iran is clearly intensifying its campaign against the Jewish state and other enemies with Iranian sponsorship, typically are as well, to have some indication of international solidarity, particularly from the United States? Obviously, this is a psychological problem as much as it's an economic one, but can contributions or can solidarity being expressed in other ways really make a material difference to the people of Israel at a moment like this?
Absolutely, Frank. As I mentioned, that parade when you feel the collective hug when people come visit. I think something like 70 or 80% of the tourism are Christian tourists, and most of them, I believe, are from the United States. So come see the Holy Land. Come purchase and in the high tech sector, there's so much that's going on that is just amazing. If you're an individual or a company that needs some kind of assistance or help, I think Israel is a place to turn to. I want to mention just one little effort in the high tech world. There's a guy who was in the Mossad for 30 some years. His father was in agriculture. He was a professor at Texas A&M. He started a company that releases drones into orchards, and those drones characterize each tree. And is there enough water? Is there what's the condition of the fruit? Is there a disease, et cetera? And maps all this for orchards. I mean, it's just amazing the kinds of things. And this is happening, and it's being sold and being used in the United States. But I mean, that's just one example in my little world of the kind of things that are going on.
That are making a difference, in this case for the people of Israel, but also all of those who benefit from Israel's products, and indeed for the rest of the world. It's a great and heartening story. Buy Direct from Samaria is the initiative. Gary Schiff, thank you for bringing it to our attention through the Jewish News Syndicate recently and for the work you're doing now in Israel. Keep it up, and I hope you'll come back to us with updates. I hope the rest of you will come back tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.